Telstar was relatively tiny. It weighed less than 170 pounds, a fraction of the size of today's communication satellites. The first broadcasts on Telstar included a live news conference by President John F. Kennedy, play-by-play of a Chicago Cubs game, and an outdoor opera in Rome. Telstar was only in service for about 6 months, though. Its fragile transistors failed after being zapped by radiation from high-altitude nuclear weapons tests. Craig Windham, NPR News.
At least two young children are among the 13 people killed when a pickup truck carrying 23 people veered off a highway last night and crashed into trees in South Texas. 10 others on the truck were injured. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic, offering convenient care to treat life's unexpected, non-emergency conditions. Christie Clinic convenient cares are located in Champaign, Urbana, and Danville with weekend and extended hours. More information is at ChristieClinic.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Howard Rheingold. He is someone who, for many years now, has been writing about the power of information technology, the internet, mobile phones, all of these things really before their power became so obvious. He's written about the power of the virtual community, a term that he is credited with coining. He served as the editor of the Whole Earth Review, the Millennium Whole Earth Catalog, was founding executive editor of Hotwired. He's taught at a number of universities and does an awful lot of speaking on this very subject. And certainly, he's been writing very enthusiastically for some time now about the power of social media. However, he says that these tools that he has been using, he and a lot of other people have been using now for some time, they do have their downsides. And he argues in a new book that we'll talk about that the way we use these things does matter. It matters for us. It matters for society. And in this book, which he titles Net Smart, How to Thrive Online, he makes the argument for a kind of digital literacy, a kind of approach to the use of social media that is intelligent, is humane, and perhaps above all is mindful. And if you're interested in reading the book, it is published by the MIT Press. It's out now fairly recently. His other books include Tools for Thought, The Virtual Community, Smart Mobs. He's joining us this morning by phone. And Mr. Rheingold, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It seems to be the case that, really all along here, people have asked questions about the personal computer, social networking, mobile devices, these things that you've written a lot about now. People have continually asked, well, this technology, is it good? Is it bad? And certainly recently, I think, we have had a lot of people arguing that it's not so good. I think the approach, though, that you take is a little bit different. You seem to be making more of an argument that, well, you can argue about whether it's good or bad, but the thing is that it is, and that we have to be smart about, we have to decide we're going to be smart about how we're going to use it.
Yes, that's right. In fact, you got to the heart of why I wrote the book, how I came to write the book, was that I have been writing about, in the 1980s, where the personal computer might be going, in the 1990s, about communicating through computer networks, and in early 2000s, about mobile communication. And in each case, that question came up. It came up from critics. It came up from peers. And it was a question I asked myself, which is this new technology good for us as individuals, or for our relationships, or for our society, or is it bad for us? And I've concluded, after thinking about this really for decades, that the answer has to be, it depends on how we use it. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that technology is neutral. It's neither good nor bad nor neutral. It's really not just the hardware and the software. It's the way in which people use it. And I think that this goes all the way back to the printing press and the telephone, that when something new comes along, it changes the way we act. And it's only later that we understand what maybe the price we paid for the benefits that we got. So now that I think that everyone understands the tremendous benefits of having a mobile phone and having internet access, and recently there's been some strong questioning about, you know, some of the destructive effects. And I think we're not going to, you know, even if we agreed that this technology was bad for us, I don't see how are we going to eliminate it. It's such a part of our lives. And I don't agree that it's bad for us. If you've ever been a caretaker or a patient with a serious disease, you know, and I'm sure there are people listening to me, that it can be a lifeline. It's a tremendous educational opportunity for people. It's a way for people to share interests with others that they may never have met. There are many, many benefits from it. But I think that the criticisms that maybe we're becoming more shallow as individuals, that our relationships are suffering, are definitely worth addressing. And my conclusion was, well, wait a minute, I've been online for a long time. I've spent my career writing about how to do it. I know things, and other people know things. If all of us knew those things, if all of us were able to pay more attention to how we use this technology, wouldn't that improve life for us as individuals and for the commons, for all of us?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's interesting. Someone, in talking about this technology, said, well, you know, you can divide the world into two groups, the digital immigrants, that would be me, and the digital natives, that would be, oh, say, like your daughter, people who either came to this technology after they were grown up, or people who were born into it, and so people for whom there always was an internet. And I can see that the people who might be most drawn to this book and trying to come to grips with this would be the immigrants, not the natives, and that it's hard to persuade that for people who've always, you know, people who grew up with a smartphone in their hand, or people who grew up sitting in front of a computer screen, that there's anything that they don't already know or anything that they need to learn about how you use those things. And how do you make the pitch to the digital natives that this is something that they need to think about?
You know, I discovered that there's a surprise about this idea of a digital native. So I am a digital immigrant. I remember I had a modem, which is a technology that the digital natives probably never experienced, which plugged my telephone into my computer way back in the 1980s, and it was so slow that I could literally go into the kitchen and put on a cup of coffee while I logged on to a bulletin board system. My daughter is what they call a millennial. I started teaching about 8 years ago and was very surprised, teaching students at Stanford and at Berkeley. You know, in the heart of Silicon Valley, you would expect these to be not only digital natives, but pretty savvy ones.
Mm-hmm.
When I said on the first day of classes, you're going to be blogging every day and we're going to be editing the wiki, I was surprised at the number of blank looks that I got. And I learned that I had been assuming that this myth of the digital native was generally applicable to everyone who could text on their mobile phone with their hands behind their back, or who Facebooked like crazy all day, as many of these young people do. But, you know, I discovered that doesn't mean that they know how to use a blog to advocate, or how to use a wiki to organize, or really how to do a kind of internet search using a search engine that would enable them to find accurate information. That they're not stupid, but this is a complex technology that's moved very quickly, and nobody's really teaching them. I mean, if you think about it, very few schools teach people how to search, and knowing how to read and write is something that you learn fairly young. Why do we continue to go to school and teach composition and rhetoric? It's because knowing the alphabet, knowing how to read and write, is not the end of it. You need to learn how to make a composition. You need to learn how to make an argument, how to do research. And I think the same is true of this technology. It's not really rocket science. It's not even as hard as learning the multiplication tables, but it is something that has happened so quickly that our schools, our educational institutions, our parents really haven't developed a way of teaching the kids the new facts of life.
In the book, you make the argument that there are a number of basic sort of skills or ideas that you'd like people to think about. And I'd like to have you talk about mindfulness, which I expect that you mean not in the Buddhist sense, but in the psychological sense. That is the way the psychologists talk about it, in the sense that it means paying attention to what you're doing. And in this particular case, I think you're saying what you really are encouraging people to do is when they're using these tools, don't just do it in a sort of mindless way. Pay attention to what it is that you are doing.
No, I think one of the largest criticisms and really the basis of what the problems may be with the use of the technologies we have today is that we're using them unconsciously. Mm-hmm. You know, the Pew American Internet Life Study, which does very good scientific polling, has discovered that 1 in 6 Americans have admitted to bumping into something or someone while walking down the street texting. And I bet you that some of your listeners saw that video that went viral on the internet that came from a mall camera that captured a young woman who was looking at her phone while texting and fell into a fountain in the middle of the mall. And I bet practically everybody has had the terrifying experience of driving at high speed down a freeway and noticing that someone in a car next to them is looking at their phone. They're either texting or dialing a number. It's scary the way that these technologies call our attention, whether that's good for us or not. So I think that, you know, the first principle of learning how to handle all of the media that we have is simply to become aware of where our attention is. Mm-hmm. This was highlighted for me, of course, when I first stepped into a classroom. If you are a professor in any college in the world these days, you know that you're not facing your students. You're facing their laptop covers. They're looking at their laptops, and many of them are checking it out to see whether you know what you're talking about. They're searching on it, and some of them are messaging each other about what you're talking about, and undoubtedly some of them are on Facebook or some of them are on a gaming platform. It's something that for the last 1,000 years, teachers have never really had to face. People's minds wander, and they look out the window, and they doodle, but never before have you had the entire internet to compete with what you're saying. So we've got these calls on attention, you know, in the home. I think the most tragic example is the parent whose child desperately wants them to look at them while they're talking to them, but we're on our BlackBerry or we're on our iPhone. It's really become an epidemic, and I think we can control this. The technology itself is not to blame. What's to blame is our inability or simply our unwillingness to begin to become aware of how we're deploying our attention and to make some changes. And it turns out that this mindfulness business, you mentioned Buddhism, so the contemplative traditions, thousands of years old, have always talked about paying attention to where your mind goes. And a lot of meditation simply consists of sitting there and watching your breathing and noticing how your mind wanders and bringing your mind back from wandering, beginning to control it. We now have some very good neuroscience. I cite a lot of it in the book, and there's one of the many books that I cited called The Mindful Brain by a neuroscientist gets into detail about this. You can learn to change the way you pay attention. That's what meditation is about, and it's what a lot of training is about. And the idea that multitasking, for example, makes you more efficient, well, we've seen neuroscientific studies come out very recently that show that most media multitaskers are actually degrading their performance. So can we learn how to pay attention when we're online, how to pay attention when that phone rings. My evidence from looking at the literature and at experimenting with it myself is that the good news is that any attempt to try to become more aware of where your attention is wandering when you're online, when you're carrying your phone, is immensely better for you than not trying at all. And then from there, you can take a series of steps to really not just take control in the sense of not having negative behaviors, but take control in the sense of really knowing how to use your time online most effectively.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus. We're talking with Howard Rheingold, someone who has written a lot about personal computing, social networking, the importance of mobile devices. He is the author of the books Tools for Thought, The Virtual Community, Smart Mobs, and his new book, it's titled Net Smart, How to Thrive Online. It is published by the MIT Press. Just for a second to stay with this idea of multitasking, and I think you have said that some people, young people particularly, would make this argument and say, well, I can do this. I can pay attention to all these things. I can pay attention to you, Mr. Rheingold, when you're there at the top of the, at the head of the class, and I can pay attention to my Facebook, and I can do my email, and I can, you know, all that other stuff. And there seems to be evidence that actually a lot of people can't, but there apparently are a few people who actually can. What makes the difference between those who can really do this and those who perhaps think they can but can't?
Well, you really put your finger on a very interesting question that we don't have a scientific answer for. But to those who say that multitasking is universally impossible, I would simply say take a look at a jet fighter pilot. They have to aviate, navigate, and communicate. And that's when nobody is shooting at them. Were these people who were born with a particular capability, the way some people can run faster or jump higher, or were they trained to do that? We don't really know that yet. And these experiments, the one by Clifford Nass at Stanford that showed that 95% of the media multitaskers who think that they are more efficient actually are not, really haven't looked into what's happening with that 5%. Some people call them supertaskers, and the question is that native or is it learned? And I think, although we really should wait for the scientific evidence to come in to be sure about this, that the evidence on the way meditation and other kinds of attention training, like jet fighter pilots, affect people's brains indicates that it's entirely possible for people to learn how to do it better. And I think we need to think of two things. One is it possible for us to learn to multitask without losing effectiveness? And the other one is it possible for us to simply train ourselves to know when to multitask and when not to multitask? So I think efficiency, which pretty clearly the evidence shows that you lose efficiency when you multitask, is not always the only criteria. Sometimes you need to get the big picture. You need to see how things are connected. Sometimes you need to sort of be in the flow. And that has to do with paying attention to a lot of different things at the same time. But, you know, when I was writing the book, I think this is a good example. A lot of the people who have studied this recommend that you set a timer and you work on a project and you focus on that and you don't pay attention to the little red badge that says you've got email. You don't pay attention to the cute cat videos that somebody is linking on Twitter. You just focus on that for 20 or 25 minutes. And then when the alarm goes off, give yourself 5 or 10 minutes to go check your email or take a look at Twitter. Whatever you want to do, allow your consciousness to travel, to wander, but then get back to the focus. So I think it's really not a matter of focus is good, multitasking is bad. I think it's a matter of knowing when to take the right tool out of the mental toolbox, when to put it back. If the word mindfulness sounds a little bit too spiritual for you, you could use the word metacognition. Wikipedia has a pretty good entry on metacognition, And that has to do with not just knowing where you're deploying your attention, being aware of how you are thinking. It's being aware of what are the different kinds of mental tools that I have. Well, I've got focus, I've got multitasking, I've got analysis, I've got flow. There are a lot of different ways of deploying your awareness. Being aware of what all your mental tools are and which is the most appropriate one to use at the moment. My child is speaking to me. I'm going to put the BlackBerry down. I'm driving a car. I'm not going to pay attention to that buzzing on my phone. I've got to get something written. I'm not going to look elsewhere on my screen until I've finished that task. I think we can learn how to do that. I've started training myself how to do that. And I recommend to people that they think at the beginning of their day, when they sit in front of their computer, what is it that I want to accomplish today? And use your old right brain and write down on a piece of paper two or three things that you want to accomplish. I mean, just two or three words per task. And put that in the periphery of your vision. When your eyesight falls upon this piece of paper, ask yourself, what am I doing right now? What am I paying attention to? And is that getting me any closer to my task? There may be days in which you don't have a deadline, in which following whatever links you want to follow, learning whatever you want to learn is a perfectly legitimate thing to do. And there are days in which you need to remind yourself, I need to spend more time in focus. Just by beginning to do that, you're actually changing your brain. There's a saying among neuroscientists that neurons that fire together wire together. When you begin developing these attentional habits, you're actually setting up and strengthening brain circuits that enable you to do it more easily the next time.
And the thing is, when you lay it out that way, it sounds so easy. But the thing is, I think we know, is that what these technologies offer to us is very tantalizing, and that developing this small amount of discipline that says, at some times you need to focus on the task and you need to be on task, and at other times, if you want to surf or graze or, you know, whatever word you want to use, that's okay. You just got to know when you have to do the one and when you can do the other. Saying it like that is easy. Why, though, is it so hard to do it?
You know, I think that people who do what I'm talking about and what I write about in the book are going to discover that the difficult part is getting started. Developing a new habit is always difficult at the beginning. There's a professor at Stanford by the name of B.J. Fogg who actually teaches a course on how to develop new habits. And my little exercise about writing down on a piece of paper and then asking yourself, that's really derived from his three-step process, which is start small, find a place for it, and repeat. So it's pretty easy. It takes about, I'd say, 20 seconds to write down a couple of things. It's easy to just glance at that piece of paper and ask yourself, where am I deploying my attention? And if you do it every day, it begins to develop a habit. So I'm not saying take a look at your tasks and then discipline yourself. I'm saying just start by becoming aware of it. So I think you're right that there's a steep slope that people can climb to become extremely expert, and it's not easy to do that. But it is easy to get started. You make the decision to get started simply becoming aware of what you had been unaware of heretofore is the world's easiest thing. And once you start becoming aware of it, then you begin strengthening those circuits, it becomes easier. So I wouldn't try to leap into becoming an expert at controlling your attention. I would start with that first step and keep in mind that first step makes the second step easier.
I mentioned that in the book that you make the argument that there for series of different kinds of digital literacy. The one here we've been talking about, the idea that you really need to pay attention to how it is that you're using the technology and what it's doing. Let me ask you about one of the others, which is, I think, a serious issue. Certainly people talk about it being a serious issue, and that is the fact that there is a wealth of information available at your fingertips now through the internet and through these many devices that we have, and some of highly dubious quality that can actually look good if you don't look very closely. And that this another one of these skills that I think you're arguing that people should be taught but perhaps aren't being taught is how to evaluate the source of the information that you're looking at. You do a search, you arrive at a website, it looks good, it has what seems to be information that's useful or what it is you're looking for, but then you say, well, you've got to ask yourself, now, wait a minute, who is this? What is their agenda? How do I evaluate what it is they're telling me? You can't just take it on face value because it looks good and because it's on the internet.
You know what? When my daughter, who is now in her late 20s, first started writing papers for middle school, that was when search engines first came along. And I felt it was important to sit down with her in front of the computer and say, you know, something fundamental has changed here. You used to be able to trust the information that you find. You can go to the library and you get a book out, and maybe you can disagree with that book, but pretty much if people made factual claims in that book, somebody checked it. You put a term into a search engine, it's really magic. It's like a magical spell. If you know the right words, you can get the answer to any question. But now it's up to you to determine whether that the answer that you get is accurate or not. And the example I used with my daughter years ago was go do a search on Martin Luther King Jr., the late civil rights leader. And on every search engine, on the first page, you will find a site called martinlutherking.org, a true historical examination. And if you look at that site, you'll see that they have a pretty bad opinion of the civil rights leader. If you do a little bit of searching, you can find out that the site is actually run by a white supremacist organization. It's what they call a cloaked site. There are lots of other sites that aren't cloaked sites of people with a political agenda. Some of them are hoaxes. Some of them are jokes. There's the endangered tree octopus, which looks like a completely legitimate site about a non-existent creature. There's a kind of scary site that's called the Online Pregnancy Tester. There are sites that claim that they have cloned primates that can understand English. It's the world is full of these things. You know, it's not that difficult to begin asking some questions about the information that you see. You can look for an author, put the author's name in a search engine. That will tell you a great deal about the site. When you're talking about medical information, I think there isn't anybody these days who doesn't Google their symptoms. Or when they get a diagnosis or a loved one gets a diagnosis of a serious disease, they search on that. The consequences of not being able to evaluate your information well when you're doing medical searching can literally be a matter of life and death. If you know how to look for it, you can find good sources of information about how to assess medical information online. Political information, we're all getting these kind of scurrilous rumors about political candidates of all sites, all stripes, in our email box. How do you tell whether that's true? How do you tell whether you're passing on an urban legend or a hoax? Again, very, very few schools teach how to do searching. In fact, some of the research that I looked into indicates that a great many young people think, well, if it's on Google, it's got to be good. We need to be able to develop the capability of thinking like a detective or thinking like a good journalist and looking beyond the surface. I don't think that this requires an advanced degree. It's just something that we're not accustomed to doing. You know, if we could regulate the quality of the information that people put on the internet, we wouldn't have the internet. We can't really control the quality of information on the input side. What we can do, though, is increase the number of people who have a clue about whether the information they find is good information or bad information or misinformation, and refrain from passing that along.
We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Howard Rheingold, someone who is quite well known for writing about social media. And he's the author of a new book, Net Smart, How to Thrive Online. We'll talk some more with him in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, hosting the 2012 Grassroots Radio Conference, July 26th to 29th in Urbana. The conference brings together media artists, organizers, radio operators, and citizens to learn, discuss, and brainstorm. More information and registration is at grassrootsradioconference.org.
In this hour focus, we are talking with Howard Rheingold. He's a very influential writer and thinker on social media. He has written a lot about things like personal computing, social networking, the importance of mobile devices, and he is the author of the book Net Smart. It's subtitled How to Thrive Online. It's published by the MIT Press. It's just out now. He has authored several books. In fact, some of his others include Tools for Thought, The Virtual Community, and Smart Mobs. You know, one of the things that I try to do, if I can, as I'm getting ready to talk to with someone like you or somebody who's going to be on the show, is I like to go out and look and see if I can find interviews or talks that people have given. I like to hear people, you know, in their own words. And I did, in fact, come across the thing you did at Google with your daughter, who works for Google, and I thought that must have been an interesting experience for you. Having her be the moderator of this conversation at this incredibly influential internet institution.
Well, it was, of course, very gratifying to be able to do that and to have her be interested enough in my work. But it was also, I think, important to talk to these people who are very, very expert. And I find that even the most expert don't know everything there is to know about all of the literacies. So they may know a lot about search. They need to learn some things about attention. I wrote about a couple of other literacies about collaboration and participation and network awareness. The reaction to my conversation with my daughter was so good that we're thinking of doing some Google Plus Hangouts that we can broadcast and have conversations about it. It's pretty interesting you know, I started thinking about this stuff when she was in middle school and, you know, when she was 11 years old. And before Google existed, the search engines back then had names like InfoSeek and AltaVista. And now she's in the heart of it. So that was great, great fun. And I'm at the point where I'm really learning from her. When I wrote this book, talking with her and talking with my students and really trying to understand what was in the minds, what the young people knew and didn't know was important. It is a book like my other books in which I try to footnote every factual claim I make. You can go look up the scientific research that it's based on. But the book is essentially not a scholarly book. It's a prescriptive book. It's about here's what I've learned, here's what I've learned from my daughter, here's what I've learned by talking to Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, and Jane McGonigal, the expert on gaming. I've gone all around the world and talked to experts about this. Here's what I think you would be better off knowing and how to go about knowing it if you're going to spend your life online.
Yeah. Let me talk about, or have you talk about another one of these literacies, because I think it's important that people think about this. The potential here for the technologies that we're talking about is huge. And certainly you wrote about the power of these tools to help people come together to organize for some kind of collective action. And you wrote about that, I think, before people were really even doing it. But I think the problem is here, perhaps, that people will get distracted by the entertainment features of these tools, and there's nothing wrong with that, really, or the possibility that you can indeed learn some things and do that on a solitary basis. But I think that what you would say and a lot of other people would say is that one of the real important potentials here is that very thing, that is bringing people together, whether they're physically together or not, and, you know, people who have some kind of common goal or goals, it can be a way for them to pursue those goals. But I think you're also arguing that not everybody who thinks they know this technology actually knows how to do that.
No, I think one of the most wonderful things about this medium is the capability of people who may not have known each other before to collaborate in so many different ways. I wrote about virtual communities as early as 1987, but now we've got so many different genres of collaboration. You've got virtual communities. You've got smart mobs. You know, I wrote smart mobs in 2002, but it wasn't really until 2011 that we saw the Arab Spring in North Africa and the Middle East, and we saw the Occupy movement. I think it took that long for the literacy, for the understanding of how to use social media to organize political action to spread. But we've also, these days, we've got crowdsourcing, we've got collective intelligence. You know, one of the stories that impressed me was about a computer scientist by the name of Jim Gray, who 5 years ago took his sailboat out on San Francisco Bay and didn't come back that night. Because he was a computer scientist, he had a lot of friends in the computer world. They got satellite photos from NASA and Google. Microsoft engineers cut 500,000 photos of the area he disappeared into smaller pieces, and Amazon put it up on their Mechanical Turk program so that thousands of volunteers could look through it. They looked through 3,500 square miles of ocean. They didn't find this guy. But think about it. They just put this together ad hoc with tools that were available online literally overnight. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, for example, there was a Harry Potter fan site in which people who were fans of the Harry Potter series wrote about Harry Potter. Warner Brothers, who owned the copyrights to Harry Potter, tried to shut that down. Their lawyers sent a letter to the website. Heather Lawver, who had organized that website, organized a worldwide boycott of Warner Brothers until they backed off. She did it so quickly that the Warner Brothers attorneys didn't realize she was 16 years old. And we've had just many, many, many instances of people being able to mobilize, whether it's for medical support, whether it's to you know, organize some kind of boycott like Heather Lawver did, or political activity, or to, you know, on Twitter, you know, a lot of people think that Twitter is only frivolous. People organized an online benefit in which they raised $250,000 to bring clean water to villages that had not had clean water. We've got microphilanthropy. We've got organizations like Kiva.org in which people can send $25 or $50 to someone elsewhere in the world to do something, to begin a business. We've got so many opportunities to make the world better, for people to make their lives better. Only a fraction of the people who are online understand how to use the media to their advantage. How much better would it be for individuals and for all of us if those literacies were widespread, were widely taught? So far, they've just kind of been spreading by word of mouth. But in the book, I talk about if you want to organize crowdsourcing or a virtual community or a kind of collective intelligence, here's what we know about it. Here's what you can do. Here's how you can participate. Here's how you can organize it yourself.
Is your thought that that eventually these kinds of literacies will be part of school curricula, and that's one way, at least, and maybe the best way to get people to have these kind of skills?
You know, I certainly hope so. There's kind of a political obstacle to this, which is that there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of kind of moral panic about the Internet. And certainly there is unwholesome material that young people can come across there. And I simply don't think that the way to protect young people is to prevent them from learning their way around the Internet. You know, a lot of parents are afraid that their children are going to meet bad people online. The research indicates that if you're going to meet bad people, it's probably going to be a relative or a neighbor. And the worst fear, the greatest danger for a parent is letting their kids loose on the Internet without having the ability to tell the difference between good information and bad information. So we need to get somehow past this taboo on using the internet in schools. We need to train kids to use good judgment. If they don't have practice doing it, how are they going to do it? But I think ultimately we need to start earlier. Parents need to talk to their kids about the facts of life online. You know, in the future, when today's digital natives become parents themselves, I think it will be easier. I don't know whether we have that much time. I think we can agree that the human race faces some very severe and global scale problems. And I think that the greatest asset that we've got are the 7 billion human minds that we've got. We've got such tremendous access to this technology. We've got 2 billion people on the internet already. We've got 5 billion mobile phones. There will be 6 billion this year. A significant percentage of the human race has access to this technology. If they knew how to use it, if we could educate everybody about how to use this technology better, think of the problem solving. Not just about, you know, creating wealth and prosperity. It's about solving some of the very serious problems that we've got.
Well, given the fact that, as you say, that there's now a great deal of penetration of people who have some kind of portable mobile device that has internet access, having said that, though, do we still have reason to be concerned about there being a digital divide and have some people who have access and some people who don't?
Oh, and absolutely. That's a significant portion of the human race. Doesn't mean everybody. But I think that we also have a different digital divide. I think that capitalism is going to solve the problem. The cost of distributing these devices is dropping, and the people who sell them want to sell them to everybody. But the divide between those who know how to use the device that's in their pocket, to summon their social networks, to find the information that they need, to participate online, to collaborate online, to network online, I think that the division between those who know how and those who don't know how is going to be as serious as the division between those who have the financial means to access the technology at all and those who don't. I think that gap is closing. The education gap, the literacy gap, the know-how gap, I think is not closing as quickly. To me, the good news about that is that the amount of capital investment required to wire the world and equip everybody with a supercomputer in their pocket is so much larger than the cost of teaching people how to use it effectively.
We have maybe about 5-6 minutes left. A couple of times here I have run down this list of things that you have written about: personal computing, social networking, importance of mobile devices. And the thing that I really want to point out to people is that not only have you written about those things, but I think that you've been, in writing about them, significantly ahead of most of the rest of us all the way along. So, and that is, in a sense, writing about things really before they became so important. So given that, where do you see this technology going? Do you see that it is going in a place that will yet surprise us in another 5 or 10 years? And if so, what do you think that is?
Well, I'll give you one example. We're now beginning to see what's called citizen science. People equipped with simple sensors or simply mobile phones are doing research and contributing that research to scientific efforts that could not have been done otherwise. We have people who are classifying the different kinds of craters photographed on Mars. We have people, it's called Galaxy Zoo, who are looking at photographs from the Hubble Space Telescope and classifying galaxies. So I think we are entering an era where the methods of science for uncovering new knowledge that could be very important to us, and the participation of individuals online is combining. I think one of the most exciting things is that if you are a biochemist and you are working on trying to understand how protein molecules fold, it's an important problem if you're working on HIV or the immune system or cancer, is protein molecules are very complicated. The number of ways that they can configure themselves in three-dimensional space is so large that ordinary computation really doesn't work. But if you go to folding.stanford.edu, you can download some data about proteins, and your computer can automatically go through all of the different kinds of ways that it can fold and send that data back. So instead of taking years or centuries of computer time, scientists are now able to do things in months with the help of many, many volunteers out there. In fact, there's a game for the Xbox called Fold It, in which people play a game, and they do it in groups. They have teams to try to discover how proteins fold. And very recently, scientists have announced that one of the Fold It groups has discovered important data about an enzyme called protease. If you know anybody who is on medication for HIV/AIDS, they are taking what's called a protease inhibitor. This is a very important protein, not just for AIDS, but for understanding the immune system, many other diseases. So we're now seeing a way that people can play games online together and help solve scientific problems. I think the horizons of what we can do if we know what we're doing are going to surprise people, even in just a few years.
Mm-hmm. And do you foresee any significant changes in the devices themselves or in the way that people interact with them?
Well, you know, I think we're seeing the beginnings of that with Kinect, the device that Microsoft came up with, where you can literally wave your arms and control your game machine. I think you'll be able to do that to your computer pretty soon. And then we're seeing this Siri on the new iPhones, where people can ask questions and a kind of artificial intelligence can come up with answers. I think these are just really the early days. If you remember what computers were like in the 1980s, they were pathetically puny and incapable of doing the kinds of things that we do today. If you look at this kind of gesture interface, if you look at this kind of artificial intelligence answering questions that you ask it by voice, you put those two things together and you ask where they're going to be in 5 or 10 years, I think we're going to have it's going to be beyond what the Star Trek episodes showed us 2 decades ago.
Yeah. Well, that's what I do think that we're most definitely moving away from the keyboard, and what that means for how we'll use these devices and how we think about them. I think that's a really interesting question. I don't know what the answer to the question is, but it seems to be something that's coming, and it seems to be coming at a pretty rapid pace.
Well, one of the most exciting things now is that people who are illiterate can get access to health information. They can get access to information about subsistence farming by talking. They can learn to read and write by using their phone. So I think that, you know, we're going to see that bottom one-fifth of the world's population, of the economic ladder, are going to begin to use these devices to feed their children, to avoid disease, to make their lives better. So I think it's those of us who are privileged to live in a world where we can carry smartphones with us all the time and have broadband, we're going to see miraculous things. But also people who are just struggling to keep their children alive and put food on the table, they're going to be able to do that in ways that they weren't able to do so before.
Mm. And are you still surprised? Do you find yourself continuing to be surprised?
You know, on a daily basis, there are things. I no longer think that things are impossible. The things that I thought were going to be years away in the future suddenly pop up.
Mm. Well, at that, we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Howard Rheingold. If you're interested in reading his writing, you go out and look for his books, Tools for Thought, The Virtual Community, Smart Mobs, and his newest, the title of that book is Net Smart, How to Thrive Online. It is published by the MIT Press. And Mr. Rheingold, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House at Green and Lincoln, 3 blocks from the Engineering Quad. Hendrick House Catering can tailor a menu and price for events from corporate box lunches to weddings, business meetings, and other special events. More information is available at 365-8004.
On the next Fresh Air, why some people can't handle drinking coffee and why some babies are born with tails. Science writer Sam Keen tells the stories written by our genetic code. And we'll meet Jill Tarter. She's the scientist Jodie Foster's character in the film Contact was based on. She spent most of her career looking for signs of intelligent life in outer space. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
On tomorrow's Focus, in the 10 o'clock hour of the program, knowing where you've been is essential to knowing where who you are and where you're going. To that end, our brains take fleeting bits of information and put them together to construct a version of our past. We'll learn more about the formation of memories on the personal and societal levels as we talk with Thomas Anastasio, Associate Professor of Neuroscience, and Wenyi Zhang, a doctoral candidate both from the University of Illinois. They say that groups of people remember and forget the same way individuals do. It's a rebroadcast of a conversation from May of this year. That's in the 10 o'clock hour. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, in light of the circumstances in Aurora, Colorado this past Friday, we're going to rebroadcast a conversation from January of this year focused on the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. That'll be in the 11 o'clock hour of tomorrow's program. On Wednesday, the conversation will turn to cybersecurity. Jay Kazin from the College of Law at the University of Illinois will be the guest in a rebroadcast from May of this year. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, the conversation will be about the social conquest of Earth, how we explain the willingness of one person to sacrifice for another. The guest, Dr. Edward Wilson, Emeritus Professor of the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University. Well, how's that for a business card? Yikes. Rebroadcast from May of this year. That'll be in the 11 o'clock hour on Wednesday. On the next Market Warriors, pickers Miller, John, Bob, and Kevin are in the City of Brotherly Love seeking finds at the Philadelphia Flea Market. They'll sort through trash and trinkets to find that one great item to sell at auction. Notable picks include a set by French jeweler Marcel Boucher, a kitschy ice bucket, and a Japanese mixed metal vase. Watch Market Warriors. It's tonight at 8 on WILL-TV. And one other TV program to tell you about on Friday at 8 o'clock. Changes in Cuba are inspiring a new generation of musicians, each of whom chose to leave Cuba to make a musical career abroad, only to return home to reinvigorate the musical life of the country they left behind. Now the sounds and rhythms they embraced from other cultures, including jazz, hip-hop, and soul, are injecting a new spirit into the traditional Cuban music of their childhoods. This transformation's on display in the documentary Havana, Havana. You can see it Friday night at 8 on WILL-TV. All right, let's get you updated on the commodity market's latest tick, starting with Kansas City wheat for September. It's trading at 927, that's down 14. December wheat at 944, down 10. March 2013 wheat at 947, down 4. Chicago wheat for September is trading at 922.5, that's down 20 and 3 quarters. December wheat at 928.5, down 19 and 3 quarters. March 2013 wheat, 918.5, down 6.5. September corn is trading at 814 and a quarter, down 10 and a quarter. December corn at 789 and three quarters, down 6. March 2013 corn at 780 and a quarter, down 1. August soybeans at 1716, that's down 41.5. September beans at 1666 and three quarters, down 46.5. November beans at 1638 and a quarter, down 48. August soybean meals at 528.10, down 14.90. September soybean meal at 510.90, down 17.40. August soybean oil at 53.56, that's down 80 cents. September soybean oil at 53.77, down 79 cents. August live cattle is trading at 118.27.5, that's up 32.5. October live cattle at 123.35, that's up 25 cents. August feeder cattle at 135.85, down a quarter.
rather make that down 25 cents. September feeder cattle at 137.92 and a half, down 60 cents. August lean hogs at 93.60, that's down 10 cents. October lean hogs 79.25, down 55 cents in trading on the day. Mostly sunny and hot the rest of today in Champaign-Urbana with the high around 98 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a slight chance for showers and thunderstorms, the low 75. Tomorrow, hot and humid, slight chance again for showers and thunderstorms with the high 95. The heat index, that indication of temperature plus humidity, what kind of what it feels like out? Well, it could be as high as 107.